Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 24th, 2015, and welcome to episode 101, or 5, of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, media preservation, and whatever else. I'm Paul Hagstrom. I'm here in Boston, and with me today is Earl Evans, who is in Portland. How are you, Earl?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thank you.
Excellent. Jack, how are you?
No, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. It's actually turned warm here officially, warm enough for me to go out and have to mow the lawn.
Excellent. And joining us for the beginning of this podcast is Laurie Emerson, who is in Boulder, Colorado. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Summer's in full swing here. We didn't hear about the weather in Portland. How is it in Portland?
Oh, well, it's a little overcast, but it's not raining and it's not cold, so I'm not going to complain.
Excellent. And apparently there's some kind of power outage in Toronto and a storm in Colorado. okay, so that's the weather news. So today we have Laurie Emerson joining us. She's the founder of the Media Archaeology Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, I think, right?
That's right.
Okay, and so today's host topic is basically going to be just media archaeology, sort of what this lab is doing, what Laurie's doing, how she founded it. But so, Laurie, maybe you could start by just sort of saying a little bit about how you got into the project and what the project is.
Sure. I started the lab in 2009, and back then it was a project just to maintain access and to preserve this very early work of digital poetry by a Canadian poet by the name of B.P. Nichol. And B.P. Nichol created probably one of the first kinetic digital poems in 1983, a beautiful little piece, a suite of 12 or 13 kinetic digital poems. He made it an Apple Basic on an Apple IIe. And back in 2009, I think maybe that year, a group of writers and artists in Vancouver made available an emulation of that work online in the form of a QuickTime movie. And what I wanted to do was try to really get at what difference it made to interact with that work on the original platform and look at the code, research it and teach it with my, 18, 19, 20-year-old students. So what I did was I stocked a room full of Apple IIe computers, 15 of them, and I got this work on a 5 1/4-inch floppy, and I pulled my students in there, and we all worked on this poem. And then just, I think probably because nobody was watching what I was doing, it's turned out that being ignored really works to one's favor. The lab just sort of morphed over time. I started to then collect Commodore 64s because I thought that was another comparable, popular personal computer of the same era. And then it just kind of went from there, and I started meeting people on Twitter and, strangely enough, on eBay. I made some really good friends on eBay, and people started giving me stuff, and it turned out to be really fantastic stuff. So that's basically how it's gone. From there, my emphasis has been less on early works of digital art and literature, although I'm still interested in those, and more just on old, so-called old media that still works. And I keep, my interests keep expanding, unfortunately. So I recently picked up an Edison Diamond Disc phonograph player that I found in a used furniture store in Boulder for $170. It's from 1912. And works perfectly with this beautiful little crank arm, and it came with 30 diamond discs that are about a quarter of an inch thick. So I think the strength of the lab right now is definitely our collection of personal computers from, I think our oldest machine is probably an Altair 8800B from 1976 through the 90s and the early 2000s. So that's the lab in a nutshell, a very small nutshell.
Yeah, it's so you have a pretty good website with, you know, sort of a catalog of the computers you have and good pictures of them, and yeah, it's very impressive that you have the Altair and Alisa and NextCube and all these rather, I mean, collectible machines, you know, even over and above the value in reading media and experiencing things. Yeah, it's a neat site to look through. So you got started, you're in the English department, right? Or at least the Media Archaeology Lab somehow falls under the English department?
Yeah, I was hired in the English department, so sort of by default, the lab too falls under the English department. Starting in September, I'm going to be split between the English department and a new college that CU is opening called the College for Media Communication and Information, and then the lab will probably move over there. I think it makes sense having it in an English department, but not always to more traditional scholars, I suppose. I do think that there's a really strong connection to literature in the way that literature scholars read texts. It's sort of a methodology that you can apply to reading machines or reading media, and also just thinking about how works of art and literature are created. So just shifting the interest a little bit away from just reading the artifacts themselves, like just reading the text, and more looking at the production process.
One of the things I was wondering was, there's sort of a couple of different angles on this. It seems like one of them is kind of, you know, experiencing the digital work as it was originally intended to be experienced, but then there's also sort of like an archiving aspect to it. Just because I do some sort of, I don't know, amateur archiving myself, I wonder kind of how you classify and present, and how large is the archiving operation as opposed to the sort of keeping computers usable. Oh, and actually that's another question that maybe I should have asked after I let you answer the first one, but how do you keep these things working?
I feel like a lot of what we do is just the seat of our pants. the way I keep them working is just by constantly networking and trying to meet people that know how to fix the machines. And I've been really fortunate to find ardent enough fans of the lab that I can almost always find somebody to come to the lab and fix something that isn't working. Or I've just been able to buy a replacement on eBay. But it's been really interesting to me to notice that there is a new generation of students coming along that surprisingly does have expertise in electronics, and really they're passionate about old media. So I'm starting to create partnerships with these young people in their early 20s who are able to come to the lab and very often fix whatever's gone on the fritz. So no highfalutin procedures for keeping them working. I try to make sure the lab doesn't flood. The lab is in pretty unglamorous location right now. It's in the basement of a house that I think is from the 1920s or the 1930s. So yeah. Nothing climate controlled or anything like that, even though I'd love that to be the case.
Although, I mean, part of the stuff that we like is the fixing of the stuff, and, you know, the sort of the joy of getting something that wasn't working. So those students who are coming in doing that are also getting something out of this, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. So, And, you know, I really strongly believe that they are learning literacy skills even for the 21st century, even as they're repairing these machines that are 30 years old. But they're actually getting access to the roots of our contemporary machines, if you know what I mean, by learning how to fix old machines.
Yeah, we've actually, this is Earl, we've spoken quite a bit about that on the podcast, that sometimes the early computers actually give you a better glimpse into first principles of how computers work and how they were used at the beginning. So it can be quite educational. I was curious, since you mentioned folks in their 20s, what the typical reaction is for folks of that generation. We're also talking about that frequently, what the next generation thinks about the first generation of computers. Do they look at them as antiquated devices like, oh, these are archaic, they're not very fun? Or are they enthused about them, or is there a range of reactions? What do you encounter?
I'd say across the board, close to 100% of the students that come to the lab, and again, they're 18 to 21. Occasionally, if I get some grad students, they'll be in their mid-20s. They love it. They absolutely love it. And I haven't been able to quite figure out why. I haven't been able to, you know, theorize about it. Part of it seems to be this weird nostalgia for an age that they never lived through. So, I don't know. They seem to be nostalgic for their parents' era of machines. One of my other theories is that they love the lab and the machines in the lab because you can open them up and you can kind of understand how they work in a way that you really can't with contemporary machines that are all hermetically sealed and seem to work really mysteriously and magically. And I really think, too, that they're feeling burdened by this 24/7 culture of connectivity. And they come to the lab, and these machines are not hooked up to the internet. Everything that the machines do is very simple, but I think elegant, and I don't know, they seem to love it. I teach them a lot of media theory, and every time I bring them into the lab, they all say, "This is awesome," which of course makes me really happy.
What do you feel like the lab lacks? What would be the next great thing that you could get?
Other people have asked me that, and I haven't really come up with much. I guess I don't know. I feel like we have so many cool machines, and there's so much stuff to be done in the lab that I don't really feel too strong of a yearning to keep adding more and more stuff. I do kind of wish we had a Commodore PET. That would be great. I also wish we had a punch card machine, even though I would have no idea how it would work. I'd really like to have one of those in the lab. Yeah, that's all I can think of right now.
It is a really impressive collection. I mean, part of when I was looking at it, I was sort of thinking, you know, mainly what's missing are sort of intermediate incremental models, you know, not in major lines.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing that's really obviously missing is that we have no PDPs or no mainframe computers, but they're so massive and they're so expensive and they take up so much room, I'm not really sure that we could ever go down that road, even though I'd like to.
So is someone going to mention the PIDP8?
Oh, that's true. There are reproductions of some of those machines that you speak of that are actually kind of small and might give people a flavor for what they look like, but don't take up an entire room in order to do so. So maybe that's something we could send you some links offline and you take a look at that. I'm also curious about the intersection between media archaeology and the academic world. I mean, probably one of the most noteworthy characters that we find ourselves intersecting with a lot in the retro computer community is Jason Scott and the Internet Archive. But aside from that, I don't have a lot of visibility to that world, and I'm wondering, is there a community in the academic world for media archaeology, or are you kind of one of the only folks you know of, or what does that world look like?
That world seems to be mostly in Europe. It's although it's starting to grow in North America, I think any academic who's starting to work in the field of media history is starting to identify with the field of media archaeology, even though media archaeology is, I think, more interested in rethinking how we tell history and how history is created rather than just straight conventional history. Most of the media archaeology people are in Germany and the UK, and there's a few people in Sweden. It's really, to me, it's strange and it's very hit and miss. I'm going to Sweden on Tuesday to give a talk. This is the second time I've been in Sweden to talk about the media archaeology lab in a year. So it's always surprising to me to find out what countries seem to be really interested in it. And Latin American countries, for some reason, are I don't know if they're obsessed with media archaeology per se, but they're really excited about the lab, and I haven't really been able to figure it out. But in terms of in the U.S., I have maybe 4 or 5 colleagues who work in media archaeology, but that's about it.
Well, I'm curious, since you mentioned that you're coming to Sweden and have been here a couple times recently, like where is there, are you in kind of people at universities who are doing this sort of thing, or is it just individuals who are sort of into this, or like I'm just curious in general, like, and for that matter in Germany as well, are there people who are like you in academia or outside of that who are mostly who you have contact with?
Yeah, it's I'd say half of them are in universities and the other half are hackers or artists who have some relationship to museums, archives, and universities. So it's a little cluster of people that all sort of gather around media archaeology. There's also some artists in Sweden who seem to be working on it. There's a couple that I'm not going to get to see this time, but they're in Gothenburg and they work with teletext and fax machines. And they're obsessed with creating teletext art. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So it seems like one of the things that is kind of important is the original media. And so I wonder what you think about just the fact that at some point, you know, there will be some point when the bits just fall off. You know, like the discs will no longer hold new bits. Is that... I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? You know, like as compared to emulating media and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I haven't been able to quite come to a conclusion about that. I was just thinking that to myself yesterday, that I bet 20 years from now, either the lab won't exist or the lab will have to turn into a museum. Whereas right now I like to call it an anti-museum museum because of the way that everything is meant to be turned on and played and tinkered with. And that's just not sustainable. It's just not going to be possible for too many more years. And I really sincerely believe that that'll be a great loss when that happens. I mean, not the loss of the lab per se, but a loss in terms of our ability to, I don't know, to have access to the past, but also to have access to tools that help us think about how things could have been otherwise and still could be otherwise. I feel like there's a lack of imagination nowadays because there's sort of a sense of inevitability about technology that we're only able to passively accept these tools and machines as they're given to us and not actually think about how they could be otherwise. And having access to these old machines, I think, is a great way to try to think about, to think outside the box, as the cliche goes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I think we all kind of like about that early 80s, late 70s era, is just that everything was being explored. You know, we didn't know who the winner was, and you know, so all the different computer companies went different ways and were doing different kinds of things. And it does sort of seem like now, you know, I'm not all that excited to hear about what the next, you know, the successor is to the computer I'm using, because it's just going to be, you know, a little bigger and faster and with smaller pixels.
Yes, exactly. I think I was thinking that too the last couple of weeks, hearing all this news about the new Apple Watch. And to me, the Apple Watch just sounds like the most boring device ever.
If folks wanted to help out with your collection or help you document things, donate time or equipment or what sort of things, what would be the most helpful for assisting you in keeping the lab up and running and presenting material to these generations of students?
Great question. Well, I think the thing that we need the most help with right now is labor, much more than machines. I found it relatively easy to get people to give us stuff, and it's much harder to either get people into the lab to actually help work on the machines and help fix them, or even to have money to pay to keep the lab open. That's been the hardest thing for us. But unfortunately, that's probably the same story as any organization nowadays, is that they, you know, everybody's short on funds to pay for labor. So for me, it's a real struggle from one semester to the next to try to make sure that the lab stays open, because that's really at the heart of the whole enterprise, is just making sure that anybody from the general public, Joe Blow down the street, can come into the lab and either access their own materials that they've been unable to get access to because of obsolescence, or to have a scholar or students be able to stop in the lab. So, yeah, unfortunately, that's probably the biggest thing that we need help with. And I guess if anybody out there did want to participate or be in touch or help out in the lab at all, they could just email me directly, Lori, Lori.Emerson@gmail.com. And I'd be very grateful to hear from people.
I think I sort of have asked this before, but is part of your mission actually trying to archive things that are not yet archived? I mean, is that one of the things that you do?
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to get back to your question. Yeah, I am really interested in trying to archive hardware and software, especially the hardware. You know, there's a decent amount of activity across the U.S. and Canada and the U.K. working on software, but very few people seem to be working on how do you catalog hardware? How do you catalog media and old machines? And usually libraries are the go-to places for those sorts of things, but it seems like libraries are struggling just to keep up with the software issue, that they haven't really been able to get to hardware. Not to mention the fact that most of their training seems to be in dealing with books. Still, libraries are mostly focused on print culture rather than digital culture. So we did spend some time a couple years ago coming up with our own metadata scheme to describe each piece of hardware, and all we've tried to do is be completely consistent every time we accession and catalog a new piece of media that comes into the lab. We try to be utterly consistent in how we describe it, so that hopefully one day, if a library is ever interested in including our collection in the library catalog, all it requires is a little bit of programming to create a bridge from our description to the conventional library description. I don't know if that answers your question, does it?
Well, yeah, I guess I was just wondering, you know, I was wondering if you also had been, you know, in the trenches on getting the individual magnetic bits off disks and that sort of thing. But that's true that it isn't entirely clear how you would catalog machines, just because I do probably more of the software stuff. But, you know, there are different versions. Two different disks of the same program could have come out slightly different times and have slightly different copy protection on them, or there's a very fine-grained difference that you can see if you have the actual physical two disks that would be good to archive. And the machines, I'm sure, would be pretty much the same. You see motherboards with little, like, you know, bridges on them that, you know, fixes that were made after the first run and that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. The trick has been to try to imagine some future researcher and what might that person be interested in, and then how can we describe the machine according to this fictional possible future person. It's a really strange exercise. We also have started up our own little disk imaging station. We just got it set up in the last month, so we are starting to work on getting the bits off some of our floppies, but I have to admit I don't yet know how to do it, but we're now set up with it. We do have a CryoFlux all ready to go.
So where does the data go once it's gotten off the disk? Will it be something that you could find on the lab webpage, or is this, or archive.org or something, or is this still kind of staying in-house?
I think it is going to go up on the lab webpage. I'm just a little bit worried about the donors. I haven't quite figured out what to do with that. But in cases where maybe I don't know who the donor is and it doesn't seem to be anything terribly personal, I ideally want to put everything up on the lab website. You might see if you go to the lab right now, we have a section called, I think it's our special author collections. Mm-hmm. And we're working on scanning all the print material for some of the weird older digital art and literature that we have from the early 80s. And also we'll be putting up disk images of the floppies that we have, as long as I can get permission from the authors and creators.
That's been really interesting and a really fantastic collection. It's fun actually just to flip through the catalog and see all the things you have.
Oh, thank you. I would love to host any of you if you ever want to come down to Boulder and hang out in the lab for a day.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah, that'd be quite fun. Earl, did you have anything you wanted to ask?
Nothing left to ask. Just wanted to mention it's a fantastic work that you're doing. And honestly, while I might be biased, I think you'll probably wind up being a trendsetter. Because I think as we move forward, it is going to occur to more and more people how important it will be historically to capture all of this, whether it's individual writings or programs or computers or any of that stuff. I think the future is going to want to know, and I appreciate your work in just doing the things that you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that you can relate that it doesn't feel like work at all. It's just super fun.
That's true. Well, for us, it's a hobby, so I guess that probably says it.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you so much for hosting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you three.
Yeah, well, and thanks for coming on. Yes, okay, so we'll put links to the Media Archaeology Lab and so forth in the show notes for people if they want to, if they haven't already gone as they were listening. And so, yes, thanks, Laurie, for stopping by.
And if I'm ever in Boulder, I'll make sure to stop by.
That sounds great. I'd love to hear from any of you over email. Have fun.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and now we will turn our attention to listener feedback. We have gotten a couple of things over the email wires. Earl, you have the first one here.
Well, actually, this wound up being a protracted discussion over on the Classic Computer mailing list. In episode 100, we talked about things that we wish were out there for our vintage computers, add-ons that we would love to have but don't exist. One of them, and I think Michael initially brought this up and we all jumped on the bandwagon, was a video converter that would let us connect our old vintage computers to modern monitors, whether that was composite or separated, like the Commodore 64, RGB, that kind of thing. And like I say, quite a discussion ensued with people talking about how they would use various techniques to digitize, process, try and extrapolate what was going on, and then push that out to something like, for instance, like to an HDMI monitor. And some of the challenges I frankly had never thought about. For instance, I guess some of the early computers used interesting techniques with the composite signal to get the colors. I guess the Apple II in particular used some interesting signaling techniques to generate the colors that it did. And so if you were trying to process that signal and figure out what does the Apple II actually mean when it's doing this, you'd have to understand how the Apple did that. So interesting stuff, and who knows, we may see a product or two come out of these discussions. And if not a product, maybe that's too far. It might be just a kit or some instructions on how you could build it yourself. But lots of people had great ideas using things like FPGAs and digital signal processing and yada yada. So I love it.
Yeah, it was interesting to see it go, and it's, you know, as we said last time, it's definitely a category of thing that I think everybody would like to see. Oh, and okay, so another piece of listener feedback, Jack can cover.
Yeah, so Peyton wrote in to mention that he's got a thing called Atom Disk, or Atom DSK. Basically, he was messing with a Coleco Atom, and he wanted to do some sort of cross compiling on his PC and put it onto an Atom Disk. and found that there was actually no good tool for doing this at all. So now he's created some tools for doing that. So just like we have other tools for dealing with disks and disk images for Apple and Commodore and Atari, now he's set up something similar for the Atom, which is cool if you're into the Atom. I'm not really, but I remember that at the time that when I bought my very first computer, my Atari 400, I looked long and hard at the Atom also and decided not to go for that. But for those of you who are into that sort of thing, computer with a built-in printer for that you probably can't use anymore, I'm sure there's other things just fine, but I bet that printer does not work anymore.
But actually, the horrible thing about the Atom is that working or not, you need it because it's the power supply.
Exactly. It's got to be there. Yeah. So anyway, looks interesting. It seems to be a Windows-only tool at the moment right now, which would probably make me turn away from it just because I don't want to deal with installing Windows anywhere. But there you go.
Yeah, no, it's neat. It's interesting that this didn't exist before, but it's neat that it does now. Anyway, thanks Peyton for writing the thing and then writing to us. So we can move on to the items of interest and news. Earl, you have the first one.
Yeah, a shout out to Comvex, the Commodore Vegas Expo, because the version 11 is coming up soon. July 18th and 19th, 2015, at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. And Bill Hurd of Commodore fame is going to be there presenting. Also, here's a teaser. There's a possibility, this isn't confirmed, but it's a maybe, that Leonard Trammell will make an appearance there also. And if so, I imagine that would be quite a hit and some good backstory there with the Commodore and Atari history. As usual, they'll have lots of fun presentations. They've got lots of activities lined up. You can read all about that on their website. And that link will be in the show notes. It's at portcommodore.com. It's on their wiki. And lots of stuff to go read there. And you can see some photos, too. They always have a good time at the Comvex show. I talk to a couple of my buddies who go on a regular basis, and they love it.
July 18th and 19th. I think that's... is that not right in the middle of Kansas Fest? I think it is. But there may not be that much overlap between the two audiences.
Two different crowds.
Jack?
Yeah, well, while we're on the Commodore side of things, I saw something that popped up in the past week or two. There's been an announcement made for a computer, an upcoming computer, called the Mega 65. This is touted as being a sort of modern, open, 8-bit computer. The design is clearly inspired by the Commodore 65, which we've talked about before. It was Commodore's, at one time... It was going to be the evolution of the Commodore 64 into a little bit better device with 3.5-inch floppy and stuff. Never actually happened. But they've clearly taken the physical design, well, the case design of this computer looks like that. But it's got it contains a very modern CPU, which is still an 8-bit CPU in some ways, but can address much more memory and things. I don't really understand the details, or I haven't dug into the details quite enough. It's supposed to be compatible with the Commodore 64 in some sense, but also run 50 times faster. Which sounds pretty interesting, and it's going to be, they say it's like an open source platform in some sense. You can buy it from them, or you can also get the plans for most of it from them and make it yourself. And it's built around FPGA, and the device is going to have HD output and SD card and Ethernet and all sorts of interesting stuff that will make it work in more modern environments while still being able to do old C64 style things. It's going to, you know, so it'll have, you know, skipping the problem we've been talking about with video output, it's going to have a standard modern monitor output of some kind. It has USB, it has all these things. So it looks pretty interesting. I think it's not available yet. It's something that they're working on. They're saying ready for sale in 2016. It's March of next year, quite a ways away. But who knows? And if someone is really interested, they can probably try and get on board and see if there's a way to help out and try and make this become a reality. If someone has these skills that can be used for this. So, worth checking out, I'd say.
The Commodore 65 just has such a mystique. I don't even know what to compare it to in the rest of the computing industry. It was the last gasp of the 8-bit world that almost was, but didn't quite make it out the door. Maybe if I were to compare it to something in the Atari world, it would be like the 1450 that was a prototype, and you know, some of them leaked out, but there weren't a whole bunch of them.
Right.
The Commodore 65 sort of the same way. That, I mean, there are a few dozen artifacts of it in various stages of working or not working, depending on which prototype you got. But a modern computer kit that I have called the Micromite Companion, by a fellow named Jeff Ledger, who's actually quite the Commodore enthusiast, the splash screen of the Micromite Companion looks like you're booting up a Commodore 65. It's got those colored bars up in the upper left. There's just something about the Commodore 65 captures people's imagination. I don't know what it is.
I think maybe it's just that there were so many people who kind of grew up with the Commodore 64, and the next step after that, in, you know, the next computers that people would jump to after that, whether it was to an Amiga or a PC or whatever, was kind of a big leap in terms of how a computer works. And this is, you know, this is kind of, again, going back to what we were talking about with Lori also. This is a computer that seems to be built around the idea of simplicity in some sense. I mean, it's going to be a brand new computer, but it will work like computers that we had 30 years ago. There's probably not going to be much of an OS involved here. It's going to be probably pretty much you're down at the bare metal in some sense with most of what you're doing with this machine, I would guess.
Yep, I think you're probably right.
I do really kind of like that, you know, C65 shape, though.
Yeah, the form factor is pretty neat.
Yeah, well, and for people who kind of know what it is, it would be kind of nice to see the shock and awe of someone seeing that you have this on your shelf or, you know, sticking out of a box or something.
But, yeah.
However, I suppose that will become less shocking when everybody buys the new machine.
I would like to have one if it doesn't wind up being too expensive. One of the things that I would have actually liked to have had one of the look-alike machines that came out from that reborn Commodore company in the U.S., but they were just a little bit out of my price range for nostalgia.
Right.
I don't know about those at all. What was the deal with that?
Oh, there was a PC-compatible computer that came out that had the look and feel of the breadbox Commodore 64.
Oh, right. I do remember that.
I sort of remember it being announced, and then I kind of forgot about it. But it did actually come out?
It did. It came out, and some people bought them. And I think you can see a YouTube unboxing video if you go up there and look. I believe that the person who founded that company wound up passing away. It was really sad. And I don't know what their status is now. I would have to go out and check. But I will say the computer that they came up with looked really nice. It was a beautiful piece of hardware. And like I say, I probably would have jumped to own one had the price not been out of what I could afford to pay for it.
Oh, neat. Okay. Keep an eye out for that.
Set a timer for next March.
Yeah. Okay, so I have the next one. So Ken Sheriff, I guess. I don't know how you pronounce that, but his name has come up before. On his blog, he has a story about Bitcoin mining on a 55-year-old IBM 1401 mainframe, where he programmed on a series of punch cards for this IBM 1401 mainframe that the Computer History Museum has, I think. Is that right? Where is this? Computer History Museum. So he basically wrote up the algorithm that does this sort of internal technical, you know, very hard task that is involved in the Bitcoin ecosystem. So I only sort of understand Bitcoin myself, but essentially it's a very sort of deep kind of like encryption decryption task that validates transactions, and it's a way to generate income in Bitcoin for yourself if your computer is doing these things. So people set up Bitcoin machines and so forth, whatever. So, and I think this is Ken himself who programmed in assembly language on this 1401 mainframe from 1959 or something. It's old, just because he wanted to, just the intellectual challenge. The ultimate result, I think, was that it takes about 80 seconds per hash. And the way this algorithm works is that it basically kind of trials and errors its way through a whole bunch of hash checks until it gets one that fits. And modern computers can come up with one in something like 10 minutes or something. And the conclusion here was that it would take about 40,000 times the current age of the universe to mine a to mine a block effectively.
And it would come up with the number 42.
Right. So the electricity to do it would cost $10 to $18.
Wow, that's almost our national debt.
Right. And for your trouble, you would get 25 bitcoins or about $6,000.
Nice.
So obviously an intellectual exercise, but it is kind of neat to see these, you know, the big powerful computers of the past trying the big powerful problems of the present. So so he's got the source code there if you wanted to actually just, you know, see how you would do this. It's a neat article.
There's even a nice animated GIF showing the blinking lights on the front of the IBM 1401 while it's doing its work.
Yes. Very nice. Very pleasing. Okay, that's it for that. Earl, you had the next one.
You know, I find that the CPM world doesn't get a lot of attention, but if you peel back the onion a little bit, you find out that there's still all kinds of things happening with CPM enthusiasts, still new software being written, and lots of fun is going on. So I went out searching, as I do from time to time, over on the comp.os.cpm usenet list, and found a new utility from a CPM enthusiast who calls his site Floppy Software. He makes CPM utilities, and they're available for the low, low price of free. And he just came out with one, or perhaps this is an upgrade of one that he'd come out with, called TE. It's a self-described humble screen-oriented text editor. And it does what you would imagine. It lets you edit text files. It's nice, though, that it uses screen controls as opposed to some of the text editors that are in the CPM world that are line-by-line kind of editors, like some of the ones we started out with. You guys remember Edline?
Sure.
So, yeah, the fun we had with that. Another utility is called Samuru X, and this looked really cool. It's a Unix-like shell for CPM, and it's got lots of built-in commands, lots of things that you expect to see in a Unix shell, with environment variables and pipes and all kinds of fun. So I can't wait to try some of these out, either on a CPM emulator, or I guess I'll have to charge up my PX8 computer and get some of the utilities over onto that and play with it. But the site is www.floppysoftware.vacau.com, and we'll have the link up in the show notes. But check that out if you're a CPM enthusiast. And also, keep an eye out on the comp.os.cpm group. You can find that over on Google Groups. And there are frequently interesting postings over there. If you're a CPM person, you may already know that. But if it's something that you're just digging into, that can actually be a fun place to hang out.
I've never actually used CPM at all. All I know is that it's an operating system. And that was primarily on the Z80, and that's all I really know. But, like, it's interesting to see the especially this Samuru X, these things that, like, standard in, standard out, and piping and stuff, which, you know, these are things you're very used to in Unix. I guess I kind of assumed these things existed in some way in CPM, but I guess maybe they didn't. I don't really know.
Yeah, not a lot. No. You had command line parameters. You had a program called pip that you would use to move software around from one device to another. It was a much more simplistic operating system than a person by modern standards might expect. One of the things that I do like about it, though, it was really eloquently and modularly designed. People who look at the source code for CPM, and I'm not a Z80 source code person, I can't really read much of it, but people who have looked at the source code say this was really put together well. You know, I mean, when you think about modern software development techniques, tight integration but loose coupling, between different pieces. You had some of those things starting to emerge in CPM, the division of labor between the BIOS, which was hardware dependent, and then the BDOS layer, which was designed to be more hardware independent, and then what they call the transient program area, where your software would exist and call those API functions. Everything was really nicely layered. It was actually a beautiful thing. So that may be one of the reasons why it's hung around in people's interest for so long.
Okay, cool.
It's also it's really small. I mean,
that's true.
You can run it on very low power machines.
Well, isn't it also the case that, I mean, the original MS-DOS was kind of a CPM-inspired work?
Absolutely.
Yep, and I think there's argument about like how to interpret the word inspired there.
How inspired was it? Was it?
I think I was saying inspired in quotes.
Right, yes, I think I could hear that. Okay, Jack, oddly, you're the one who's talking about the next thing.
Yes, on to me. So Jason Scott posted an interesting thing. It's an article about a bunch of Apple II software that has been re-cracked in the modern era. Basically, the point being that there's been a lot of, obviously, Apple II software that you can get online, and people can complain that, well, this is the cracked version, which could mean either that it's missing some stuff, or it could just mean that you see some more or less ugly text and graphics from whoever was the cracking group that dealt with this piece of software when it came out. So someone called 4AM, I don't know who this is, that Jason's writing about, has been going through a lot of old software and just re-cracking things. So taking your old original Apple II software and going through the process of cracking it again to make a new cracked version of a piece of software that does not have anything changed except for disabling the copy protection. So you can launch this software and see it as it was in its original form without saying, you know, brought to you by whatever, Cracking Group A.
The Canadian crackers, right?
Hey.
4AM is constantly busy with that. And if you follow the Twitter feed, you'll see that there's just a ongoing barrage of software that is being fixed, cracked, and archived. Yeah, that is a lot of quality work.
Yep. And this person is talking about this, writing about this somewhere, I believe. I can't quite link to it, though.
Yeah, well, I've been following it relatively closely, and so one of the things that's actually really cool about this is that in the process of deprotecting the disk, 4AM will also write up a sort of walkthrough of how that happened. You know, so what goes wrong when you try to copy it? What do you have to do in order to get it to copy? You know, what are the tricks that the software protector put forward? And so it's also kind of like a tutorial on how to crack your own programs as well. But he's done 300 or something like that, I think, by now. It's there's quite a lot, and many of them are things that nobody ever bothered to crack before. So they're educational titles that were there was no doubt that something like Karateka was going to get saved, but physics level 4 for elementary school or whatever is unlikely to have really, no one really put the effort into that. So that's another sort of second aspect of this. There's the educational one, and there's also the sort of preservation one. And then even for the popular things that got distributed in cracked versions, the ability to see the original title screens as they were intended and so forth, because a lot of times those get removed just so that the cracking group can put their name all over it and, you know, their BBS list and so forth.
So this seems very cool. Clearly you guys knew about this before, but I did not. So. News to me, thanks to Jason Scott.
Yeah. So the thing that Jason was pointing out here is that like one of the things that's new is that a lot of them are now playable right in the browser.
Oh right, yeah. That was the actual news. Yeah, they're on the Internet Archive. You just click and play.
Excellent. Yeah, I know. Cool. I'm quite interested and pleased with that project, and hopefully it will continue on. But I mean, it's very educational to read those, and entertaining too to read those text files describing how it goes. Okay, all right. So I have, I think the last piece of news, which I'll only just sort of briefly mention. I don't think we've actually said this specifically before, but the Amiga is coming up on its 30th anniversary. So July 23rd, 1985 was the introduction of the Amiga, and July 23rd, 2015 is soon. And so there's a 30th anniversary event. I don't know if it's actually on the 23rd, but coming up in approximately that time. It's happening at the Computer History Museum. And there was in fact, a Kickstarter that funded this, that sort of helped make this happen. But anyway, there's a few things that are happening. I'll make sure that the link Amiga30.com is in the show notes. It'll look just like that, Amiga30.com. But if you're interested in this, you should check that out. I'm sort of ashamed at how little I have followed the path of the Amiga. Actually, both of you know a lot more about it than I do. Do you know more about this event other than that it's happening?
I know nothing about this event, unfortunately. It's at the Computer History Museum, which is a place that I've wanted to go to for a while and have never been there yet. But that's all I know. Now, I don't know anything about what's going to happen here. But it's hopefully a good time. It'd be interesting to see if they get some interesting people to show up. They do seem to have some of the original Amiga developers turning up there. And some other speakers that are listed. I don't know all these names. It's on the website and people can go take a look. But it seems like I'm sure there's going to be some interesting things going on.
I do hope that some of the stuff shows up in video later. Also, Pac-Man turned 35. That was a big deal recently. And which means that the Google Doodle that you could play Pac-Man in turned 5. So... I'm sure people actually remember that, but for a day at least, you could play Pac-Man in the Google logo on the Google page. So, okay. So that will wrap up the news. So now a word from our sponsor.
You'll never finish by morning.
No problem. Now, command the powers of Atom with professional keyboard, high-speed memory drive, and built-in word processor program, all in one package.
Oops, you gotta start over.
Relax, Atom. We've got paragraph.
Is that legal?
And print.
Atom, even a letter-quality daisy wheel printer.
You did it!
Atom. My launch sequence.
Is that legal?
Command the powers of Atom and program your future.
Okay, and we're back. I have a post-retro computing gift idea, and this time I am going to suggest a range of t-shirts that Retro Connector, he's made some shirts that have the patent drawings generally for a couple of, these are Apple products, but, you know, so the mouse or the Apple III or the 128, actually it's a Twiggy Mac. So if you're interested in wearing the patent drawing, they look quite nice. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. But what do they cost?
I think they cost $20.
Yes, they cost $20. Anyway, so that's my pick.
Well, I would like to have the Apple III one.
Yeah, I'm definitely thinking that's it was a limited run. I think it might not be possible anymore. It says 3 out of 3 sold. So
yep.
Oh well. So congratulations to those three who got the three.
3 out of 3? That's a terribly limited run.
Yes, right. Well,
does the patent drawing for the Apple III include references telling you to have to lift it up and drop it?
I doubt it, but I hope so.
The title of the shirt was actually Drop 2 Inches.
Yeah.
Okay.
The drawings are neat. Mm-hmm. I've seen them. You can actually, I think, find them if you search the patent office site. You can find the document, not all that nicely scanned, but... Okay, so now we can turn our attention to eBay. So, Earl, what did you find?
I found a ZX80 Sinclair, and it looks to be in pretty pristine condition. It's guaranteed that it works. I don't remember, let me scroll down here, whether or not it was still sold as is. They say, bear in mind that this one works and is not beat up, broken, or missing parts. Folks in the retro computer collecting world will know this is a pretty rare artifact. They don't come along that often. For one in this nice a shape, I think they might actually get what they're asking, which is a $350 buy it now. But one of the reasons that I wanted to highlight this auction is there is a make offer. So if you want to do so, you can make them an offer, and who knows, you might be the lucky winner. They actually have a picture of this plugged in and working, which is, yeah, pretty darn rare for a ZX80, that first iconic computer from Sinclair. So there you go. That's my pick.
Yeah, this you scooped me on this one. I was definitely thinking about putting this one in there as well. My understanding is that they're so rare because it was relatively quickly replaced by the ZX81.
I think that's true.
But yeah, they really are. I don't think I've ever seen one that looks this nice on eBay before. So the buy it now price is $350, and I guess you get a ZX80 and a $1 bill. $349, perhaps. I'm looking at the picture, and they use the dollar bill for scale. And in fact, the ZX80 is pretty much the same width as the dollar bill. Is long, that is.
Pretty
very
wild.
Cool.
I've never looked. I've glanced at these computers before when I've seen pictures pop up on them, but I haven't really looked closely. The thing that strikes me about the shape of this computer, it's very reminiscent of the Atari 400 with the sort of sloping upwards and getting smaller towards the middle, plus the membrane keyboard. It's like a very, very tiny, 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 tiny Atari 400 in terms of the way it looks. Cool.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that before.
They are weird looking, but they're distinctive. Anyway, yes, excellent. I don't think I will be getting it, but I do like it. It's very nice. Someone was putting together a kit you could build yourself, too. I think we probably had that featured a while back. And someone had done a reproduction of the motherboard inside that you can sort of put together. But I don't think it came with the case. I think you could just make the. I think it came with a reproduction of the membrane keyboard, and that was about it. Jack, you have the next one.
Yes, I have something I've never seen before. This is an Amstrad notepad computer called the NC100. This thing came out in 1992, and the point of this is its dimensions are the same size as a piece of A4 paper, which is the European size of paper that is similar to U.S. letter size. When this thing came out in 1992, it cost like £200, I think, which was pretty cheap compared to computers of the time. It has a little screen. It's like roughly an 80 character by 4 or 10 characters high. I forget what it is. So it's a little. The idea is it's a little sort of notebook laptop computer. Well, they call it a notepad, and it has sort of some basic software built in, like a word processor and a calculator and stuff like that. And also the serial port and the parallel ports. So you could print directly from this. Use a serial port to save your stuff somewhere else, I guess. I didn't quite find out info about what it has for like onboard storage of any kind. It seems like it must have something. If you're going to be writing a document, you got to save it somehow. So I suppose it has some sort of NVRAM of some kind. Anyway, it is right now only £5 listed for on eBay, which seems cheap. And they claim it works, and they claim that it appears to have hardly been used. Seems like a neat thing. And in looking at this, I found that there are some websites where people who are fans of this machine talk about it and have different stuff. So,
see, you led this off by saying when this was released, and I totally spaced when you said
1992.
It. Okay, yeah.
So a bit later than what we're usually talking about stuff, but still certainly a vintage computer at this point. So worth taking a look at. It's kind of like, it kind of reminds me of this, I forget the name. There was a model number of this TRS-80, the little portable thingy.
Mm-hmm, 100.
It contains a version of BBC Basic, so you can actually do some programming on this thing. And it's supposed to be, it's 80 columns wide and 8 rows high, the screen. And they say it'll run for 20 hours on 4 standard AA batteries.
So it's kind of like a cross between a Model 100 and like a Palm Pilot or something.
Right. Yeah, so it's a better screen than that. Like, the screen can do graphics and stuff as well. It's not just text. Some of the screenshots show, like, it has a main menu screen that shows sort of graphical representations of the different functions you can activate. You can open a calendar, the word processor, the calculator, go to play games. And playing the games shows a little sort of iconic 3D rendering of what looks like a Tetris piece. So it looks kind of cool.
Well, certainly if it winds up being £5.
Yeah, for £5, it seems really, really cool. We don't know what it'll end up going for, obviously. It goes for almost another week from now, so.
Excellent. So the episode will even be out there before it ends. Okay, I guess it is my turn. So I have, continuing the theme of nothing from North America, I'm highlighting a rare Jupiter Ace collection. This is another thing that very rarely shows up on eBay. And so my understanding from this auction is basically that it doesn't work. The seller's not sure quite what's wrong with it, but actually does list a fair number of the things that were tried. So there's a Jupiter Ace, a power supply, a blank circuit board, a RAM pack, and trying to plug it into the TV didn't get anywhere. Doing some swap out of chips didn't get anywhere, but maybe it's an easy fix for someone who knows what they're doing. So it's not super cheap. It's £190, so it's not super cheap, but it actually doesn't sound that expensive for what these are. Although I think everyone who looks at these now and thinks about the fact that they failed to buy one when they were new is kicking themselves. Because, I mean, it's a little ZX81 shaped piece of plastic, but it runs fourth. So I thought, Jack, you'd find that interesting.
Yep. That's pretty cool. Yeah, actually, a friend of mine has done a Jupiter emulator for iOS. So you actually run something like this on your iPad, which is pretty cool, and does the fourth and all that jazz.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it might be neat to just have it to see. But again, you know, I think they were cheaper than what this one is going for, new.
And there is a make offer.
That's true. So good luck on that. It's basically there until it's sold. It's 29 days left. So. And actually, just one other thing that I wanted to point out, there's a relatively complete-looking Coleco Atom set that I think it works. Actually, I don't know, I can't see if it was tested. But anyway, it does seem to have all the pieces. It has a printer and the main computer and the some tapes as well. So if you're interested in the Atom, like, you know, as we mentioned at the top of the show, there's no way you can communicate between the Atom and your modern Windows machine. This doesn't seem like it's starting at a particularly high price. It's $110. Shipping's pretty awful to me, but anyway, it's worth taking a look. They don't come up this complete that often.
Yeah, it's a neat-looking computer. I love computers that have a more stylish keyboard, especially ones that use color to offset the keys. If I wind up ever getting myself a newer style keyboard with some of the Cherry MX keys, I'll probably get custom keycaps with different colors, because I've always liked that style.
Okay, so now that everyone is sufficiently poor from going through the eBay auctions, we can close out the discussion. Earl, did you have anything that you wanted to sort of finish us off with?
Yeah, I wanted to whine a little bit. I have some cheese with my wine. I took out my VIC-20 and I plugged it in, and the video's all messed up. And the last time I had taken it out to play with it, it worked just fine. And it reminded me of this concept that I hear vintage computing collectors talk about, shelf rot or closet rot. Whatever you call it, it sucks. Why do these things fail just sitting in this is in an air-conditioned room. It wasn't even out in the garage or anything like that. It's in a dust-free Rubbermaid bin-style container. It just sits there and goes bad from just sitting there like a loaf of bread spoiling. It's the strangest phenomenon. But now I'm going to have to figure out if I'm able or willing to fix it. And it's kind of a specific bummer, because this was the computer that got me into retro computing. I had had a wave of nostalgia for the VIC-20 because it was my first computer ever that I owned back when they were new. And eBay was a fledgling thing, worldwide garage sale sort of deal. So I wondered, hey, wonder if I could find an old computer on there for cheap. And I did find it, and it was cheap. And it was pristine, too. So I bought it, and that was 15 years ago, 15, 16, something like that. Anyway, so I guess it had a good run, but I just don't understand why it failed, but it did. So there you go.
Weird.
Sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
So So, like, what exactly is wrong with the video? Do you have no video signal, or is it just like, is it flickery? Is it rolly? Is it like, what's going on?
It's kind of, I don't know how to describe it. Some of the things are working and some are not. I wrote a little basic program just blind and ran it, and I could tell that the program was running. So the processor's working and the rest of the circuitry is working, but something in the video world, either the video RAM or the VIC video chip, something has decided that it's not quite happy anymore. It's not completely failed, but has mostly failed. So
have you tried just opening up and reseating the chips? Because I think those are all, it has a lot of socketed chips probably.
Have done that, and also eyeballed inside to see if any capacitors or anything like that looked obviously blown up. And none of that helped, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it was worth a try, though.
Well, it might be you know, informative and instructive if you do fix it to find out what it was.
Yeah, well, there's, among other resources, a site by a fellow named Ray Carlson that actually doesn't live all that far from me, but he was a repair person for a long time, and I think still fixes Commodore computers from time and again, and he has a great site with troubleshooting resources. So I went there and I looked specifically at his VIC-20 instructions for trying to track down what chip it might be. Here's the problem, though. I don't have another machine to swap out chips. I don't have spare parts. So that's going to be one of the challenges of trying to fix this if I do decide to repair it. But, you know, it's back in the bin for now, and I'll sit and just, you know, kind of mourn its loss for a little while, and then at some point I'll take it out and maybe try and fix it up. But closet rot, you know, that might be an interesting topic for one of our shows going forward. I might use that as a host topic someday.
See if there's any, like, if we can figure out the scientific basis of closet rot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Cosmic rays, you know, that kind of thing.
And Jack, you have something here.
Yeah, I just have a little thing to mention that I actually want to plug. So I have a retro-themed game coming up that I've made for iOS and Apple Watch.
Ooh.
Which is interesting because I don't have an Apple Watch, and yet here I have a game coming out for it. So that's the way it is with technology these days. This is inspired by an old monochrome handheld game that I had in the 80s. It was called Dungeons & Dragons. It was an officially licensed thing, but it wasn't much like Dungeons & Dragons. The game was actually a lot like Hunt the Wumpus, I have been told, although I've never played Hunt the Wumpus, but you're basically in sort of a maze and there's a dragon and there's a bunch of pits. And this game is called Pits of Death because the main characteristic of this game is that you keep falling in pits and dying.
You get eaten by a Gru.
Okay, well here you don't get eaten by a Gru. You fall into a pit or you get eaten by a dragon. So and
wow, that's so much different. I can't wrap my mind around it.
Gru, dragon. Think about that. So anyway, so what I modernized it a bit, even, you know, so we're running on new hardware these days, but I kind of liked the look of the old segmented LCD display, you know, where every graphic has a spot on the screen. You can't do an animation in place. You can make characters move side to side and move around different spots, but, you know, it's not exactly pixels. And so I did the same kind of design, but in color, so I'm trying to kind of emulate the sort of color LED light-up games that I remember existed in the 80s as well. So anyway, if you're into retro games on iOS or Apple Watch, I feel weird even saying it, that I'm putting out an Apple Watch game, because I don't even know if that's a valuable thing to exist, but there it is. If you're interested, look for Pits of Death.
Neat. That's very cool, Jack.
Thanks.
So what environment did you create that in, if you feel comfortable saying?
Well, the graphics are actually all done with a Mac app called Sketch, which is that I've been using for graphics for a variety of things. And I just kind of went with, you know, I just picked some very primary colors and laid things out and then painstakingly transferred these things into a layout for iOS and a separate layout for Apple Watch. They're not quite identical. The Apple Watch screen is obviously a lot tinier, so it has a different layout of stuff. It was a little bit simpler, but the gameplay is basically the same. So,
but I mean Objective-C and Xcode?
Actually, Swift. Swift and Xcode.
Ah, okay. Ooh, the new stuff.
The new stuff. I'm using the new stuff to do the old stuff.
That's cool. Yeah, this, I mean, it probably here is not the place to talk about Swift, but I am interested. When it was announced, it seemed, I remember the keynote announcement of Swift was really quite astonishing. I definitely want to try it out at some point.
Yep. Yeah, it's a very cool language. And I remember one of the things that Apple said when they started, when they announced this, they said, well, it's like Objective-C without the C, which to me sounds like that should be small talk.
Objective.
Because Objective-C was kind of C plus small talk. So if you take away C, you can talk with small talk. But it's not at all what it is. It's very unlike small talk. But what can you do?
If I think of Objective-C without the C, I just imagine a whole world of square brackets.
Yeah, just bracket city.
Square brackets everywhere. I'll have to take a look at that myself.
And for me, let's see, I actually have no particular closing discussion point, I don't think. I'm realizing that probably every couple weeks I've been saying, oh, just miscellaneously scanning things and archiving stuff. And what I have been doing this past couple weeks, or recently at least, is try to deal with the fact that I now have just a hard drive full of a bunch of like unfiled, scanned, and archived things, and I'm just trying to organize them and put them in some place that I can then make them kind of accessible to someone other than me. So turns out scanning actually can be somewhat of an intensive process, because once you get the bits off the copier or off the scanning plate, then you need to fiddle with the contrast and crop it and OCR it and all that stuff. So that I've been just trying to catch up so that I can work more incrementally in the future. So that's all for me.
That's good stuff.
So I guess that's it for this long show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are happy to hear from you. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you can, please write a review on iTunes. That will help people find the show. And so, until next time...
Retro Compute!